Today I'll be giving a sermon called Rightly or for Ill, The Ethics of Remembering and Forgetting. And this is something I've been working on for quite some time, in fact. For the last decade or so, Ed Crane, my father, who some of you have met, has been involved in development work, specifically the reconstruction of civil societies. In the dawning years of this decade, he worked in Kosovo, in places where some of the worst violence happened during the Serb-dominated ethnic cleansing campaign under the auspices of Slobodan Milosevic's government. Mr. Crane was assigned a particular region and tasked with constructing local governments that would be truly representative of the people, to include total restructuring of city councils if necessary and possible. But what he found in most cities was two very different stories about who had been persecuting whom for hundreds of years, structured in terms of both familial rivalries and rivalries between Albanian Muslims and non-Muslim Serbs. In many places, he found two separate city councils, both reporting to the mayor, but neither in contact with each other and with overlapping representation for parts of the city. And he found a Serbian collective memory that traced this separatism to the days of the Ottoman Empire's depredations and the 14th century Battle of Kosovo. Two separate sets of memories structuring identity and attitudes. Two separate chains of construction for these collective memories. Two ways of doing violence to others before any violence actually took place. I began to see part of the problem as being what people chose to remember, and very importantly, how they chose to remember it. Put this side by side with the work of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Committee to create a national collective memory of apartheid which incorporates all members of society. This did not magically make modern South African society non-racist, but it could have been far, far worse. Put this side by side with post-9/11 injunctions to never forget. And it seems that the way a collective remembers is subject to deliberate intervention and can be done to good or ill effect. This idea that peoples have an ethical obligation to remember certain things, or that at least certain things not be allowed to pass out of memory, reaches far back in history. On your order of service for the day, you will find a moving quote from Brother John Clynn, a 14th century friar in Ireland during the Black Death. Moving, but not cheery, it's the Black Death. Having watched all members of his abbey, as well as most people in the villages they served, die from this dread illness, he wrote these words as part of a chronicle to bear witness to what occurred. He said, "Unless things which should be remembered perish with time and vanish from the memory of those who are to come after us, I, seeing so many evils, and the whole world, as it were, placed within the grasp of the evil one, waiting among the dead for death to come, have put into writing all the things that I have witnessed." After reading this and thinking about my father's experiences, the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and the never forget mantra that we all heard after 9/11, I was alert to the fact that memory behaviors can be done rightly or for ill in this very moral sense. And I began to see numerous ways in which this applies to the interactions of individuals as well as collectives. And that's what I'd like to speak about today. Forgetting a birthday, a wedding anniversary, a beloved child's school play, or a dear colleague's important accomplishments is often met with blame, whereas remembering them can engender praise. Those of us who assign blame or praise to our spouses, friends, children, parents, and colleagues for what they remember and forget generally do so without, I think, having answered very important questions, or even considered them. Are we, in fact, blameworthy or praiseworthy for such remembering and forgetting? When ought we to remember, in the ethical sense of ought? And ought we, in some cases, to allow ourselves to forget, as the narrator of the Christina Rossetti poem suggested? In fact, we so often unreflectively assign moral blame and praise to ourselves and others for memory behaviors, or even just let each other off the hook completely, that memory and moral responsibility for it deserve careful ethical attention. A brief note before we begin. Individual and collective memory are not as separate as you might think. So what I'm about to talk about today with respect to individual memory might have some connections you can see to how we interrelate to others as we construct our collective narratives about history. Though individual memory is based in biology and the functions of the brain, individuals are members of collectives, unavoidably. Our individual memories are both shaped by social interaction to a surprising degree and our major loci of collective memory. Thus, determining moral blameworthiness or praiseworthiness for memory is a very complex task. Given our limited time today, again, I will speak solely to the issue of individual responsibilities for individual memory, leaving individual responsibilities for collective memory for some other occasion, like if you want to talk with me afterwards over coffee. In my scholarly work, I approach this issue by first considering a deep and broad array of sources on the nature of memory, from philosophical literature as well as decades of neuropsychological and sociological research. For all our sakes, I won't inflict that on you, and I will give you instead my brief summary. Because we have to understand a little bit about how memory works or fails to work, to understand when we should and should not hold each other responsible for it. The nature of memory raises a number of important questions for someone considering when remembering or forgetting is morally desirable. The issue of responsibility has often turned on the degree to which a person can be said to have freely chosen his or her action. Someone whose reasoning is damaged by the side effects of a medication or by severe grief, for instance, may be held less blameworthy for actions we would otherwise consider unforgivable. With memory, the relationship between malfunctions of the brain and whether we can be said to freely choose our memory behaviors is particularly problematic. We would not, for instance, hold an Iraq war veteran with poor long-term memory due to traumatic brain injury blameworthy for forgetting his wedding anniversary. Most people wouldn't anyway. Instead, we would attribute his failure to remember something important to his injury rather than to him. What's troubling about memory is that most humans have fallible memories. We don't have to have been subject to a traumatic brain injury to find that we can't always control completely what we do and do not remember. Our brains simply do not work by the traditional model which philosopher Mary Warnock describes as a storehouse, in which things that may come in handy later are put away, a kind of attic or junk room. This is a relatively static view of memory. Perhaps the contents are rearranged or maybe interconnected and stored in different kinds of ways, but they are not actually altered by remembering. Alas, according to the best psychological and philosophical examinations of memory, this storehouse view is simply very wrong. Instead, we are as a species prone to error, much of it resulting from the fact that instead of memory being a record, it is best thought of as a construction. Pieces are added, it is altered to significant degrees. In fact, memories are altered each time we take them out and handle them, reinterpreted, interconnected with other memories and knowledge, and sometimes even made false. Indeed, parts of memories that were once held in our brains can fall out of use and be forgotten. So this occurs with the very common error that some of you may not have heard mentioned or named this way, but are probably familiar with, called source monitoring error, in which you remember a claim but not the source from which you heard it. It's extremely common. You are thus set adrift when asked to assess the reliability of the claim. If, in discussing that claim with others, you defensively attribute its source to a reliable one, such as a news program, instead of perhaps the campaign ad in which you actually heard it, you have a potential problem. Reconstructing that memory might mean that you put it back differently from when you took it out. So the memory that once was, I heard that Alexis Yiannoulis, who is running for U.S. Senator from Illinois, embezzled money from a nonprofit to buy himself an SUV, but I can't remember where I heard that, instead becomes, I heard on NPR that Alexis Yiannoulis embezzled money. In fact, if you're not very careful, a month from now, when elections roll around, you may walk into the voting booth, see his name, and say, I seem to recall that Yiannoulis embezzled money, without being able to remember that you heard it during this sermon. Such source monitoring errors are distressingly common, as are alterations to eyewitness testimony if more than 24 hours have elapsed since an event. For this reason, police are urged to take eyewitness statements as soon as possible after the fact. And prosecutors and defense attorneys both must either corroborate or attack eyewitness testimony. Though such examples are helpful in understanding why it can be so hard to understand memory as a construction and why it can be so hard to assign responsibility for it, there are some other things that it would help to know. Psychologists traditionally divide the memory processes into three major areas: encoding, storage, and retrieval. this kind of makes sense if you think about how you write things down, right? First, you have to decide what to write down. That's like encoding. Then you have to figure out where to put it so you'll be able to find it later. That's storage. And then you have to figure out where it was when you need it. That's retrieval. Encoding refers to the way in which the material we encounter is attended to, processed, and prepared for storage in memory. How we attend to and process the material we encounter are cognitive matters partly within our control. In his autobiography, Speak Memory, novelist Vladimir Nabokov, who is also an amateur lepidopterist, giant fan of butterflies and moths, found that noticing the presence and taxonomy of butterflies and moths has predisposed him to both perceive and recall such creatures, as far back as vivid childhood memories of catching moths at night and showing them to his father. Nabokov recounts a conversation with a hiker who walked down the same trail he did through what Nabokov recalls as swarms of butterflies. Upon reaching the bottom, Nabokov inquires as to how many butterflies the other hiker had seen. "None," he replies. Similar instances in laboratory settings demonstrate that, in fact, the quality and quantity of encoding is highly dependent on existing knowledge and attention. In addition, the ways in which members of our collective teach us to tell stories about events affect what we notice and how we remember. Social psychologists have documented significant differences in whether girls and boys in Western culture are taught to respectively attend to and recount emotions and relationship details, or attend to and recount objects, actions, and events. Thus, upon returning from a birthday party, a girl would tend to be asked, "Who did you play with?" Whereas a boy attending the same party might be asked, "What did you do?" In general, prior experiences and social lessons and how to construct autobiographical narratives affect what we attend to and thus remember. And we can choose what we attend to and remember. That choice is something that could be good or bad morally. Storage, by contrast, pertains to how this kind of encoded information is retained. Researchers refer to the sum total of changes in the brain that first encoded an experience and then constitute its record as an n-gram. Memory researchers suggest that memory n-grams are stored better when the brain is accustomed to storing that kind of information. If you're the one who's used to balancing the checkbook, you are more likely to remember that you wrote a check that you didn't write down in the register when it comes time to balance. Accounts of the past stored externally to individual biological memory are commonly called exograms. But to avoid all this jargon, let's just think of them as proxies. It's a proxy that stands in for your memory when you write something down. Brother Clin's 14th century chronicle of the Black Plague in Ireland was such a proxy. If his brain fails utterly from death, for instance, it still persists. That portion of his memory that he chose to encode and store still is there. Other examples of proxies that we use all the time include diaries, notes, calendars, letters, devices such as Palm Pilots that beep at you annoyingly when you've forgotten to do something, and most definitely the book that I wrote for my children when I was first gestating, in which I described how I met and fell in love with their father and why we decided to get married and have children when we did. I want them to know 20 years from now that it was because of a Time magazine cover article that moved the definition of infertility earlier in a woman's life. The interplay of such external storage mechanisms and the onboard storage of individual biological memories and cultural practices through which people recognize what they call a debt to the past makes memory hugely complex and responsibility for it very hard to determine. Retrieval is the last agreed upon stage of memory processing, and it occurs when a stored memory n-gram becomes consciously available. This can happen in a variety of ways, from us remembering that we need to check one of our proxies to somebody actually saying something that reminds us of it. So if my brother calls me on October 15th to remind me that our mother's birthday is October 18th, well, I've just retrieved a memory that maybe I ought to have been able to retrieve on my own. On the constructivist view, memory construction can occur at any of these kinds of stages, encoding, storage, retrieval, or re-encoding, like the Gianulis memory. So because memory is so complex, we need to have a really clear idea of when we hold people responsible for things. Otherwise, you might think the fact that your biological memory is flawed means that you're totally off the hook, ethically. Right? You can't hold me responsible for that because human memory is flawed, and as a species, we're prone to error. Don't blame me, right? But we have a sense of moral responsibility we can use to think of how people can be morally responsible, even when their brains don't work as much as they'd like them to. Philosopher Noam Arpaly gives us this kind of useful way of thinking about moral responsibility. And she rests it on two important distinctions: the distinction between what's morally desirable and what's morally undesirable, and how responsible you are for those, the moral worth of your actions. So, for instance, morally desirable action, self-defense, maybe even killing in self-defense, if necessary. Morally undesirable action, flat-out murder. But we might have two people doing the same kind of thing, morally desirable or undesirable, and they have them be differently morally praiseworthy or blameworthy. Suppose that I accidentally render aid to someone. You wouldn't say, "Allison, you're wonderful. You're such a great person for having accidentally helped that other person." So yeah, I might, for instance, bump somebody out of the way because I tripped and that saved their life from getting hit by a car. You wouldn't say, "Wonderful, let's give you a medal," right? But if I had done it on purpose, out of deep moral concern for that person, because it was the right thing to do, that is what would make you say, "I was responsible for it and should be praised." So what Arpaly says is that, essentially, people are praiseworthy for doing the right thing if they do the right thing for the relevant moral reasons, the reasons that make it right. And you're more praiseworthy, other things being equal, the deeper the moral concern that leads to your action. So let's think about this with memory now, and let's take some other ideas into account. We can, for instance, generally say that those things are wrong, morally undesirable, that do harm to people. Could get behind this, right? And we could say that those things are right, which include doing benefit for people or undoing harm. Second, we might also assume that we can determine rules for action by considering what sort of actions tend to promote the good. All right, so generally, stabbing people in the head would tend to do harm. Therefore, as a rule, we ought not stab people in the head. I use this in class all the time. It wakes people up when they're asleep. And you also might say that generally, helping people out, if they're about to fall, for instance, and catching them, does good rather than doing harm. And by and large, therefore, as a rule, we ought to help people when they are about to fall and to catch their weight. All right, fair enough. But rules are problematic because blindly following rules can lead to great problems. One classic example of this in philosophy is the ethicist Immanuel Kant, who said, "It is always wrong to lie. Always, always, always wrong to lie." And if you've seen the new Geico ad, which shows Abe Lincoln standing behind his short, slightly chubby wife, as she says, "Does this dress make my backside look big?" And he goes, "Maybe a little." That's the example of how blindly following rules can do harm. Kant's example was that if an axe murderer comes to your door looking for your neighbor, you still have to tell him where your neighbor is. You can't lie. So we want to think maybe that rules are useful, but we can find exceptions to them that preserve the spirit of the rule while not allowing us to not follow it. So with respect to memory, now let's give some thought to memory and how we can come up with rules that help us figure out what's right and wrong about memory. Suppose that you have forgotten a dear friend's birthday, and that it is assumed in your culture that friends remember and celebrate important anniversaries such as birthdays. The same could be true for forgetting a wedding anniversary. The primary harm is the hurt experienced by your friend as a direct result of you forgetting the birthday. And the secondary harm is the undermining of your friendship. Since the harm of forgetting is based in the fact that what is forgotten mattered to the other person, and remembering is composed of these three stages we talked about of encoding, storage, and retrieval, we could construct two generalized rules. Rule number one, we ought to encode events and occasions which matter to others who can be harmed by forgetting. And rule number two, we ought to retrieve them in time to decide whether it is how to act, whether and how to act. Now, we might be concerned about rule number two because normal memory processes can make it difficult to fulfill things like, forgetting. Sometimes we forget. However, when we attend to encoding the right thing, or use mnemonic tricks and proxies to store, retrieve, and then re-encode that which it is morally desirable to remember, such as the dates important to people we care about, then we are being responsive to moral reasons. We are responding to the features that make remembering right, and we are praiseworthy for doing so, and blameworthy for failing to do so, because then we are failing to respond to the reasons that make it right to remember, preventing harm. Failing to remember is also different from what some people might call false remembering. So it is most clearly morally undesirable to remember falsely when we allow ourselves or deliberately cause ourselves to remember something which is false. Well, you might think, how could this be true? Because at the time I'm trying to remember something false, I know that it's false. Won't I remember the falseness of it? Well, there's an example from the film Memento in which the main character Leonard is incapable of long-term autobiographical memory. Some of you may have seen this movie. He uses notes and tattoos to create a puzzle of his life and task, one he has to fit together again every so often when his long-term memory fades again. One of his tattoos is a deliberate lie claiming that someone else committed a crime. This will then, he knows, in the future, allow him to take revenge for a crime that was never committed. It will justify his action. And you might think, well, this sounds very science fiction-y. How many people would this happen to? And yet, if you have ever written a diary entry or explained an event to someone in a way that makes you look more innocent than you were or makes others look more guilty than they are, then you know what it can be like to construct a version of a story that is not quite true, and especially if that's your proxy. And over time, that's what you use instead of your brain. Then what you end up with is a false memory. So from this we could get a third rule. Rule number three, we ought not to deliberately construct memories or store memory proxies so as to do others harm. Now, let's move on to one of the things that I think is most important and relevant to an awful lot of people, which is grudges. Suppose that you hold a long-standing grudge against a sibling, one which shapes your ability to remember good times with that sibling and adds negative emotions to bad memories, strengthening them. According to psychologists, holding grudges is characterized by what's called rehearsing the hurt. You pull the memory up, you remember how much it hurts, you go over it again and again. And every time that person tries to form a relationship with you, you say, but this is the person who emptied out my kiddie bank when we were 12 years old, right? So it is the rehearsal of the hurt that enables what another characteristic of grudges is, namely the lack of empathy. There's this failure to empathize with what's called the human condition of the offender. So the rehearsal of the hurt enables the lack of empathy, and that makes grudge holding a memory behavior because you're using your memory to manipulate the way you think about these other people. The memory behaviors of holding grudges and forgetting good actions that other people might do are especially harmful in combination. They tend to do harm to the rememberer, who is deprived of pleasant memories and then inflicts bad ones upon herself, and who is prohibited from acknowledging her own faults and altering her actions, because they tend to make her think, you're the problem, you against whom I hold the grudge, not I. And they harm the one who is remembered and consequently poorly treated by the rememberer. So we can create two additional rules from this, in fact. Rule number four, we ought not to rehearse past hurts in ways that lead us to hold grudges. Grudges are just simply not morally desirable memory behaviors. And rule number five, we ought to avoid the kind of negative bias that comes from grudge holding because it harms us and those around us. We might strive deliberately to construct less harmful memories. So as an example of this, if I'm feeling that I'm about to start forming a grudge against someone because I can feel myself emphasizing the negative and de-emphasizing the positive, I might force myself to remember, but in addition to the fact that my brother emptied out my kitty bank when we were 12, he also sent me important, useful things when my children were born that helped to make my life significantly easier and showed that he did care about me. So, I have one final rule, and it's worth considering because it comes from the case of Scooter Libby, who some of you may remember. He was once chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney and was convicted in 2007 of lying and obstructing justice during investigation of the Valerie Plame case. in which her work for the CIA was disclosed. The alleged lie that he told, for which he was convicted, was that he did not know she was a covert agent and could not have revealed it to reporters. There was evidence that both were the case. So Libby's defense, the one he tried to yield, to bring in court and that the judge eventually threw out, was that he had A, forgotten he had known, and B, who he had told. Libby is widely reputed by colleagues to have a terrible memory. This was not stuff that came up after the fact. People had been talking for years about how Scooter Libby had this terrible memory. So let us assume that it is morally undesirable to forget information which would lead you to A, act harmfully, and or B, refuse to take responsibility for wrong actions. This latter is especially the case because forgetting our own wrongs can lead us to recapitulate our wrong actions and can sometimes lead others to be blamed for our wrongs, causing harm to them. So this leads us to rule number 6. We ought to remember our own past wrong actions in order to avoid causing further harm. But, and this is the trick, if his brain betrays him, perhaps Libby is excused because he was unable to respond to the moral reasons that mean he should have remembered. Knowing this does, however, allow Libby to respond to those right-making reasons inherent in the last rule in one of two ways. First, he can refuse to place himself in situations where his poor memory can cause him to engage in unethical memory behaviors. For this reason, physicians and surgeons who find that they're in the early stages of Alzheimer's often cease practicing. Second, if he allows himself to be in such situations, he must compensate for his flaws with the use of proxies. So, from this, we get rule number 7. If you know yourself to have memory failures which give you serious difficulty with doing the right thing, you ought to either avoid putting yourself in situations where this will do harm or take proxy measures to compensate. So, on October 15th, when my Palm Pilot yells at me that my mom's birthday is in 3 days, in time for me to do something about it, I have done the right thing. I have responded to the features that make remembering right, and I have used a proxy to make up for the fact that my brain is prone to error, like all people's brains. So in laying out these rules and discussing their application, I've tried to present a way of figuring out when we should and should not blame other people or praise them for remembering and forgetting. So what I would ask us to do is to no longer unreflectively blame, praise, or let each other off the hook for memory. Maybe, with rules like this, and with considerations like this, we can remember and forget rightly, and not for ill.